This is Cinephile.
Oftentimes we love discussing the Oscars and saying, what's the greatest miscarriage of justice? People love saying, all right, what should have won Best Picture that did? You know, Ordinary People of a Raging Bull, Dances with Wolves for Goodfellas, Pulp Fiction losing a Forrest Gump.
Oh my goodness, Warren Beatty apparently read the wrong name. This is incredible. Moonlight won Best Picture.
Cinephile.
What do you say to those critics who say, listen, Jerry Bruckheimer's movies make a ton of money, but they lack the substance and quality of classic cinema?
No, I make movies for audiences, for popular culture. Same person who likes My Dinner with Andre is not going to like Pirates of the Caribbean.
They're thrilled to have Jeremy Renner with us. Is there any kind of friendly competitiveness on set with you guys?
Cinephile.
I think there's this more suit envy.
It's a great and lovely and talented Jessica Alba is here with us in studio. Thanks so much for coming by.
Thanks for having me.
The great Richard Lewis is joining us. At what point did you find that voice? Did you realize you could channel all this pain into humor and be the Prince of Pain?
I was about 5 hours old, and I was being put down by my family.
Cinephile.
Does Adnan Virk look like the undercover CIA agent who saves James Bond by killing a crime boss's henchman, smiles wide, extends his hand, and says to 007, "Welcome to Tangier."
Cinephile, the Adnan Virk movie podcast.
We can now officially replace the Jessica Alba fight, I think, with Margot Robbie. Thanks to her and all the guests last time. Magical, thrilling, and romantic to the core, a sensual and fantastical fairy tale with moral overtones. It's a film that plays by all the rules and none of them, going its own way with fierce abandon. That's Kenneth Turan, the veteran film critic of the Los Angeles Times. He's talking about Guillermo del Toro's new film called The Shape of Water, one of the films we'll be reviewing this time on Cinephile. Thanks, as always, for your support. Like I said, thanks to Margot Robbie. She was awesome last time promoting I, Tonya, which is one of the films we'll be reviewing this week. Also, Darkest Hour, starring Gary Oldman. He's currently the heavy frontrunner to win Best Actor at the Oscars. And also Jim and Andy, which is on Netflix. I'm sure a lot of you have seen that story about Jim Carrey, documentary during the Man on the Moon film. And Molly's Game, Aaron Sorkin's directorial debut. In addition to two heavyweight guests, not only Richard Jenkins, who for years I've said is one of the best character actors going in Hollywood. He's in The Shape of Water, looking good for an Oscar nomination for supporting actor. And also Willem Dafoe, stud, frontrunner right now to win supporting actor Oscar for The Florida Project, Platoon, Last Temptation of Christ, you name it. He's done a lot of great things, so looking forward to all of that. I know Dan is not as prolific as I am when it comes to movie going, but I just want to get one thing out of the way. Denzel is your favorite actor. Have you seen Roman J. Israel yet?
I have not.
That movie, I see the trailer and I was like, all right, well, clearly all the Denzel fans are in. Stanzik's going to be in for this. Outside chance at an Oscar nomination, now fading fast. I had a friend of mine see it and he said, story is so ridiculous and lame, but Denzel's great. Is that enough to get him a nomination? I said, probably not.
Of course it is. He's Denzel.
I'll give you the five as of now. So Oldman, Locke, he's probably going to win. Daniel Day-Lewis, Locke. These are just nominations.
You should say which films these people are in.
Sure,
I mean, Gary Oldman playing Winston Churchill.
Gary Oldman, Darkest Hour. Daniel Day-Lewis for Phantom Thread. Timothy Chalamet, I don't know if I'm pronouncing the young man's name, 21-year-old. That's the gay romance movie called Call Me By My Name. That's three. Four is going to be, looks like, James Franco, Rick Passmore's guy for The Disaster Artist, who is just hyping this thing everywhere. So he is definitely going to get a nomination, looks like. And number five, it will come to me at some point. But Denzel right now is currently six. I can call it Gold Derby. Well, while we're here, let's plug Gold Derby. So I give all my nominations when it comes to Golden Globes. Thanks to Tom O'Neill, Chris Beecham, the entire crew. I ranked number one. How shocking is that? 20 experts on Gold Derby for Golden Globes film nominations. I got 78.18%, just ahead of Tom and Jack Matthews and Joyce Eng of TV Guide. So, yeah, that's good news. And the Golden Globe TV nominations, I somehow won as well. I don't know anything about TV, so I just kind of went by some of the picks. I think because I knew Odenkirk would get nominated. Apparently, he was a long shot. I'm like, who doesn't like Bob Odenkirk? And he's in the Post. So I think that's where I was correct in that instance. But once again, goldderby.com. I know this is the time now for Oscar season. It is the best time for movies. People keep asking, is this going to get nominated? Is that going to get nominated? Here's a really easy way for all of you to do so. Just go to goldderby.com, click on experts picks, and then you'll find all my picks. The other one for actor, yes, is Tom Hanks that I currently have. So Gary Oldman, Daniel Day-Lewis, Timothy Chalamet, Tom Hanks for The Post, James Franco, Disaster Artist, Denzel just on the outside looking in. Roman J. Israel, maybe he'll get it done. So the first one I want to talk about is The Shape of Water. The two best films that I've seen so far this year are Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, which, by the way, Dan saw it. Dan, sorry, give your review of this one now that you've seen it.
I didn't love it as much as you did. Some parts were a little too much for me. I wasn't enthralled with Sam Rockwell's character. He's a hard character to like, I got to be honest with you.
Yeah.
There were some things in that movie, it was just a little too much for me. It's good. The performances, Frances McDormand, I think you said her best role since Fargo. That's accurate.
Right.
I'm trying to think of what else really.
Did you like the dialogue?
It was jarring at me.
Biting, profane, funny.
A little bit. And I think you kind of undersold. If you undersold anything, it was Woody Harrelson.
Nice.
And his whole scenario with his family really pulled at your heartstrings.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, you felt a lot of emotions watching that movie. I will grant you that.
Nice. Definitely a powerful film. Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri. The film that I love as well, though, is The Shape of Water. It is from director Guillermo del Toro. And quite frankly, it's why we go to the movies. I mean, this is a movie which is clearly made for cinephiles. And I think if you love motion pictures and you really go along with the romance, you're going to love it. Rick Passmore is also joining us here today on Cinephile. Ricky, have you seen it yet or no?
Not yet.
All right. Passmore, you'll definitely love it as a filmmaker as well, because this is the essence of it. Passmore's a guy who loves horror movies. He's made a horror film. Like, if you love those kinds of B-movies, so to speak, you're going to love this film. And if you just like romantic movies, you'll love this film. And if you love Sally Hawkins, then you'll love this film, because it has lots of different genres to it. I'll give the plot as simply as I can, because the story isn't particularly surprising. This story, you kind of know where it's going to go, and it's not all that shocking. But what is done correctly is that it's beautifully rendered by Del Toro. It's set in 1962. There's the height of the Cold War, tensions with the Russians, and Sally Hawkins, who's a terrific actress, British actress. You've seen her in Happy Go Lucky. I don't know the American film she's done, but she's definitely one of those actresses that you know. I know her in the Mike Leigh films. So she plays this woman who is mute. She's not deaf. She's mute. And she's a cleaning woman that works at this government operative agency. Octavia Spencer is her good friend who works alongside her. And they've housed this creature. And, you know, it's some alien from outer space. And Michael Shannon, of course, what other character would Michael Shannon play? Sadistic, psychotic, is the one who is, you know, making sure the creature is captured and being just brutalized. There's this one scene where he just keeps shocking him and poking him and prodding because he thinks he's this devilish creature that needs to be stopped and examined, et cetera. And the most important thing, they want to keep it away from the Russians. Then you got Michael Stuhlbarg, who's always an excellent actor. He was in the Coen Brothers, A Serious Man, and of course, is a wonderful character actor, also in Boardwalk Empire. So he plays one of the guys there, but he is the well-meaning scientist who's trying to look out for the creature and try to help the creature out. And ultimately, it ends up being a romance. That's right, a romance between this amphibian creature, who is actually played by an actor, Doug Jones, the actor. Kind of like how Andy Serkis is such a genius with CGI stuff. Doug Jones, also awesome. So they obviously have done some CGI work, but it's nice to actually have a character in the flesh. You don't feel like it's this blue screen the entire time that Sally Hawkins had to talk to. Like, no, there's actually a person living in this creature outfit, and then they fall in love. And so, as I'm describing this film, I realize either you're going to go with it or you're not. And if you're not, you're going to go, this is just too implausible and too ridiculous. But if you do get swept up in it, you see what Del Toro has done here, which is that this story is a metaphor for accepting others and accepting outsiders and finding love, and love conquers all and all the rest of it. And the genesis for it, he loved the creature of the Black Lagoon. Of course, an old classic movie. And he always wondered about movies like that. And this is the simplest way he said it. And this should actually be on the blurb. You know, when Manchester by the Sea came out last year, they had Matt Damon, like in previews, trying to sell the movie. Because they're like, how are you going to sell the movie? Well, Matt Damon produced it. He can sell it. If I was the Shape of Water people, I would just get Del Toro to go on screen and do this, which he has said in interviews on HBO. I saw this 12-minute documentary, First Look. He said, my film is Beauty and the Beast if the Beast never changed. I'm like, bam, that is exactly what the movie is. Because then all of a sudden you're going to get all these people, I would imagine, women who love Beauty and the Beast. I'm like, yeah, it's a beautifully made love story. It's romantic. And it's also funny and it's also sweet. And it's impeccably cast. I mentioned Sadistic Shannon. He's great, although I will say, as much as Dan and I like him, I would like to sort of see a little more range. Like, I'm not asking him to be like, remember when Ralph Fiennes was in that Jennifer Lopez romantic comedy? I think it was like Made in Manhattan. I was like, that was probably like his agent going, hey, Ralph, just, you know, you did the Schindler's List, you know, the villains, just try romantic comedy. Okay, we'll pay you $10 million, exactly. I don't want to say I want to see Michael Shannon in a romantic comedy, but I wouldn't mind, like, if Michael Shannon was in, like, a Judd Apatow comedy, I think it might be something different. Just I've seen a lot of psychotic, sadistic Michael Shannon. I know where his character's going the minute he comes on screen, but he's fabulous once again. He's got some physical ailments with his fingers that are just absolutely gruesome. One thing about Del Toro, and a guy like Passmore will appreciate this, like, he loves his monster movies, so he's not going to shy away from the blood and gore. So even as I mentioned this enchanting fable, Beauty and the Beast, it's still violent and bloody and gory, because that's what monster movies are supposed to be, and he's not going to shy away from that. I mentioned Sally Hawkins. She's fabulous. It's going to be a two-horse race between her and Frances McDormand for Best Actress, because her character is just filled with you know, it's such a poignant performance. You just feel for this woman. You know, she's just this mute cleaning lady, and all of a sudden she finally finds love. Like, she's the type of person that's always ostracized and ignored, and so fine. It's this creature who's this amphibian who needs to be in water. Great. As long as she finds love, that's all that matters.
When is the last time someone won Best Actor, Actress without saying a word in the film?
I think Holly Hunter for The Piano. If that's correct.
I don't know the answer. I'm just asking you.
Yeah, if that's correct, that would be my guess off the top. I would say 93 The Piano. When she played Holly Hunter. But, yeah, you're right. To do the entire role without speaking, obviously, is a real talent to her. And I haven't even mentioned our guest today. Richard Jenkins is excellent. Anytime Richard Jenkins is in a movie, Dan knows I love a guy who gives you some good decency and compassion. Much like Mark Rylance in Dunkirk, Richard Jenkins really is the audience for the movie because he's the one who's going to help Sally and somehow, you know, free this creature from these evil clutches. The Shape of Water is a beautiful film. Like I said, it's going to be polarizing. Some people are going to hate it, but I absolutely loved it. I thought it was a beautiful film, very memorable. Love the trailer. Love the music. Alexander Desplat definitely going to get nominated. He might win. Right now, two-horse race, he and Hans Zimmer for Dunkirk. But I love the movie The Shape of Water. In fact, the screener that I got from the publishers who hooked me up, I just said, seriously, I want to go buy the soundtracks because we might have some extra soundtracks available. So that's all I'm excited for. All I want for Christmas is the soundtrack to The Shape of Water. I'm giving it 4 Maple Leafs. It's one of the best movies of the year. And I'd like to go back now. You know, Del Toro, I don't believe he's definitely never won a Best Director. I don't believe he's ever been nominated. Pan's Labyrinth is his most famous film prior to this one. I'd love to go back and see that again. My cousin Zai was telling me because that's actually a metaphor for child abuse, which I don't even think I realized when I watched Pan's Labyrinth. So he's a terrific director, and it's an excellent film. Go check it out. Second film is I, Tonya. I don't want to say too much about it because we had Margot Robbie on the podcast last time. Please listen to Cinephile, the previous one. But here's the bare bones of it. It is the rather audacious story of Tonya Harding and how she was this white trash figure skater with this abusive mom, the mom from hell, who is played impeccably by Allison Janney. You can hear the chuckle in my voice because, as Margot said to us, it's like laughing in church. It's not right, and you can't help it. And that's a lot of the scenes of Allison Janney. And it's a real challenge for Craig Gillespie, the director. How do you show scenes, literally, of parental abuse and spousal abuse, and then on a dime, like 10 seconds later, you're supposed to be laughing at some outrageous stunt? And he said that was the biggest challenge with it. The two major challenges. One was the shoot itself. Dan, take a guess. How many days do most movies, how long does it take to shoot a film?
I'd say 3-4 months.
Yeah, so generally that is correct. At minimum, you're going 60 days, generally 3 months, 90 days on location. If it's a big, big movie, sure, 4 months. And then, of course, post-production. I, Tonya was shot in 29 days. Like, it is stunning on an $11 million budget. Margot Robbie said there were scenes where they had to play teenagers in the morning. They play 20-somethings in the afternoon, and then at night they'd be in their 40s. Like, forget about, hey, let's take our time with the lighting and makeup and just nail this scene. No, we don't have the time. We got to keep going, keep going, keep going. And I think that feverish rush of the pace of the shoot comes across in the movie, which has this real vibrant energy to it, and that really kind of propels you along the story. As I mentioned in the interview with Margot, Playlist, which is an excellent film critic, immediately nailed the fact it's got a lot of Goodfellas in it, especially just not necessarily, obviously, the subject matter, but just stylistically, it feels a lot like Goodfellas, the constant moving camera, the musical choices. It's all the music from the 80s that kind of pushes along the movie. It's very pulsating because, I mean, after all, it is figure skating. I mean, you think of Swan Lake. Nobody's going to be into that. So this movie gives you some 80s music, some propulsive beats. You see the vigorous nature of figure skating and go from there. So I think Margot's going to get nominated for Best Actress. I hope she does. I thought she did an excellent job. As I said during the interview, I wasn't sure she could nail the character because you think Tonya Harding, you think short, mousy, white trash. You think of Margot Robbie, you know, gorgeous Australian. But I thought she really convincingly played the role, and the scenes with her and Allison Janney are excellent. Sebastian Stan plays Galooly. But how many names could you say? If you just say Galooly, everyone's like, oh, yeah, is that the Tonya Harding husband guy? I'm like, yeah, it's a Kato Kaelin. Like, yeah, Galooly, who's played by this guy named Sebastian Stan, who's very good in the movie. Creepy, difficult, as you'd expect a Galooly to be. And just the backstory to it, when the writer met with both of them, he met with Galooly and Tonya Harding. I had them for 5 hours each. Tell me your life story. And he said afterwards, they both had completely different stories. Every single instant in their lives were different. So he said, how do I adapt this motion picture? And what he did was, he did what he does in the movie, which is breaking the fourth wall. Actors are looking at the camera saying, no, that never happened. Don't believe Tonya. This is the truth. Faux documentary style. And you've got two characters. So both are unreliable narrators trying to tell the story of what happened. So props to Craig Gillespie. I'll give it 3.5 Maple Leafs. I think it loses a little bit of steam towards the end. But I do love the performances, and I hope people check it out. And it's a real triumph, I think, for all involved. The third film to review is Darkest Hour, starring Gary Oldman, in a role in which I think he is destined to win Best Actor. One of Ben Lyons' favorites. Long, but a very good actor. And now I think he's finally going to get not only an Oscar nomination, which he also is nominated for Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, but now he's actually going to win playing Winston Churchill. And the first thing you notice about him is that he really does disappear into the role. You cannot tell for a second that it's Gary Oldman. And he said, you know, at this age, I'm in my 50s and 60s. He goes, I didn't want to put on 50 or 60 pounds. I mean, that's just very dangerous in terms of, you know, it's very deleterious. So he said, instead, I just chose to wear a fat suit. And he said, the director, Joe Wright, was actually a pretty good director. He did Atonement. Didn't get nominated for it, but Atonement's got this great tracking shot in it. And he's very good with British war stories. He said Joe never actually got to see Gary because he goes, whenever I was there, they'd have two people working on me and all the prosthetics and all the makeup. He goes, by the end of it, Joe's like, I just knew you as Churchill. That's what you looked like. And I think there's going to be a lot of comparisons to The Crown, which I know is a show people love. I have not seen it. But John Lithgow, I believe, won an Emmy for it. Apparently, he's amazing as Churchill. So I think much like what we talked about previously with Woody Harrelson and LBJ, the Bryan Cranston, a companion piece. I'm sure if you've seen The Crown, this will just be another companion piece. Here's another guy playing Winston Churchill. But Oldman is very convincing as the role. The drawback, it is, again, kind of The Shape of Water in that there's no surprises in the story. If you know U.S. history, or British history, world history, you're aware of these stories. But really, this is a testament to the power of language and the power of the written word. And in that, it shares similarities with the King's Speech. You know, they've got pages and pages of dialogue. Joe Wright said they've got scenes where, like, it would take a week to shoot. And it's a bunch of old white guys debating what to do about Hitler. Like, how do you make that cinematic? How do you make that interesting? It's just eight people arguing. Okay, you're Neville Chamberlain, you're Churchill, you're opposed to this, you think we should surrender. How do you make that cinematic? I mean, that's great for a play, but how do you make Darkest Hour sing? And credit to Joe Wright, he's got some good visual flourishes. There are well-motivated camera work. He's very inventive. He goes with a lot of high-angle shots to try to give things energy rather than just rely on Oldman's performance, which is great. He's ripping in all the dialogue, and Churchill was this... You know, Churchill was like this carnivorous character when you're watching. He's always eating. He's always drinking. He's always smoking his pipe. So, like, he's a character kind of reminded me of, like, a Falstaff in Shakespeare. Like, one of these just big, larger-than-life characters that you love being around and clearly is charismatic, but he probably can't get out of his own way. And one of the best scenes, he's talking to all the other characters, and he says, you know, temperance was not something that we had in our family. Like, just I am by nature a voluble character. I'm somebody who can be... difficult. I can be irrational. He's not a very good family man. His wife in the movie is played by Kristen Scott, I think is her name. I always forget her name. Kristen Scott Thomas. And she kind of says, listen, we knew when we got married that you were just going to belong to public service and not to me and the kids, and that's the way it is, and we understand that. So they don't delve too much into his personal life. It really does just focus on that month or so when the English were really struggling. And, of course, they mentioned Dunkirk. So it's nice if you've seen Dunkirk, you see the mentions of it and how Churchill had to plan try to get the civilian boats there and save them. So the drawback to the film, I'm giving it 3 Maple Leafs. The drawback is it just feels like a BBC-type biopic. At times it just feels like a BBC movie of the week. And that doesn't necessarily mean it's a criticism. It just feels like a solid, you know, straightforward account of what's happening with regards to British war history. I just don't find that necessarily captivating start to finish. But for the performances, for the script, I'm recommending Darkest Hour. I'm giving it 3 Maple Leafs. Go ahead, Dan.
When you say it feels like a BBC biopic of the week and you say it isn't a criticism, it is a criticism.
But you know what I mean by that? Like, the BBC does a good job with their movies. I'm just thinking in a feature film, I'm not looking for that.
Yeah, but if you said American movie that feels like a Lifetime movie of the week, it'd be a criticism.
Yeah, but I don't think Lifetime's the same as BBC.
All right, it's a PBS documentary.
Yeah, Ken Burns does some great things for PBS.
Criticism.
I suppose. I'm just saying, in terms of what you're feeling, it doesn't feel to me this grand statement. It feels like maybe it plays better on the smaller screen.
Okay.
Darkest Hour, I'm giving it 3 Maple Leafs. We're going to now listen to Willem Dafoe, one of the best actors for a long time, and then we're going to hear from Richard Jenkins a little bit later on of The Shape of Water, and a couple of more reviews for you as well. Jim and Andy and Molly's Game from Aaron Sorkin. But first, Willem Dafoe. He has been a terrific actor for so many years, and now he is the frontrunner for Best Supporting Actor Oscar. He's fresh off a Golden Globe nomination. The film is called The Florida Project, and his name is Willem Dafoe. Willem, thanks so much for coming on Cinephile today.
Sure, my pleasure.
The Florida Project is a really unique film, and it focuses on these kids who are obviously impoverished and just trying to make do with what they can. And you are, you know, the adult and this paternal figure. What was the appeal for you with this film, being, dare I say, the biggest adult in the room in terms of looking after everybody?
Well, I think initially it was I was interested in Sean Baker's work. I had seen his other films, and I thought he was he is an interesting filmmaker. And then when I read the script, it was very strong. It was a world that I didn't really know, and I wanted to enter that world. And the character also was interesting, and it was a character that I probably didn't know exactly what it was until I started doing it, but I knew that he was placed in the story in a very interesting way. He was sort of the connecting pieces, and it was also a character that had to wear lots of different hats, so there was a lot of different ways to approach the character.
Yeah, a friend of mine said that I love the fact your character is always fixing something, and how it's a metaphor for the way he's trying to repair these broken lives. And what I loved about your performance is that, you know, the character is heroic, but heroic people are not overtly heroic. You know what I mean? Like, you're this paternal character who's just looking out for everybody, and you're just trying to make do as best as you can. And that is where you often find heroism, is just when working class Americans are just trying to do their job as best they can and help people in need.
You said it. I mean, you expressed it better than I can. I think that's very true. I mean, he's not an extraordinary person, and really, all in the respect that he doesn't have extraordinary talents, or at least that we know of. But he's a good man, and he's got a kind of good-heartedness. He is trying to fix things, not out of a self-conscious altruism, but just a kind of practical. He wants to watch the ball game. He wants everybody to be happy. He wants peace.
Yeah, I love that scene where we don't know for certain if he's a pedophile, but he's this guy who's lurking around the kids, and your character very cleverly and adroitly says, "Oh, what are you doing? Oh, you need a drink? Oh, why don't you drink that tea? You know, it's a hot day." Tell me about that scene, because I love the way your character almost kind of soft shoes that, right? You're nice and charming, and then bam, you snap on the guy.
Right. You know, we're working from a very strong script, but that was a case of we had some vamping to do, simply because of the practical reason that where I encounter this guy, it's quite far away from the logical place that a soda machine is. But it's very important for me to get him to the soda machine. And if you haven't seen the movie, it's a little hard to explain. But sure. So we had to vamp, and I had to kind of manipulate him or find a way to get him to that soda machine. So it was a very concrete improvisation. And then at a certain point, when I'm convinced he's there for what I think he's there for, I lower the boom. So it has a kind of drama to it that was fun to play.
The kid performances are all excellent. Did you... I mean, you know, the one thing I was struck by was just how vulgar some of these kids are. Like, I get that. Listen, right? At that age, sure, maybe people are saying things I didn't say when I was a kid. And I completely recognize it's tough, impoverished conditions. But were you ever kind of taken aback by some of the material that Sean was putting in the film, the way this mother and daughter's relationship exists?
Yes and no. I mean, I think it's certainly the Mooney character.
Yeah.
She's 6 years old, but she's seen a lot of things, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So she's growing up fast. And, her mother is a bit of a girl child herself. They're more like sisters than mother and daughter. So I didn't find it that unusual. I know that the parents struggled sometimes with some of the swearing and some of the attitudes of the kid, but it was certainly, kids search the internet. They're looking at all kinds of things, and they're hearing all kinds of things. I mean, it's not like when you and I were growing up.
No question. We're talking with Willem Dafoe. His new film is called The Florida Project. I encourage everyone to go check it out. My wife and I had a debate, Willem, about, I don't want to give it away, but just the ending. Do you think that is metaphorical, or is that literal what happens?
You know what? You can have the debate, because I think the beauty of the ending is it's open-ended.
Yeah.
And that's not out of cowardness. It's cowardice. It's out of generosity, because I think Sean very shrewdly lets the audience participate. It really depends how you feel about the characters and what you want to happen. So he doesn't sugarcoat it, but at the same time, he doesn't end it on a downer note. He ends it on sort of a imagine. You go into a different world. And it's really up to the individual audience member to interpret where he thinks Mooney and his mother will end up.
Yeah, I love the fact, I love the fact that Sean is shining a light, like you said, on people we don't often focus on. We've all been to Disney World or know all about the Magic Kingdom, but here's also what's happening in Orlando. That really is a big part of the film. Platoon.
Yes.
Platoon is one of my favorite movies. We can go in so many different directions, but what memories do you have of that iconic film with Oliver Stone back in 1986 and your character of Elias?
It's a while ago, but I remember it very well. It was a great experience. You know, when I met Oliver, he was unlike anyone that I knew ever met in the film business. And he had a story to tell, and it was a very personal story, and it took a bunch of us, some of us quite green, most of us, some of them, some of the actors, it was their first film that they made. You cart us to Philippines, and you get some vets to train us in a serious way, and we apply ourselves to his story. And it was a great experience, and all of us really, for the whole cast, it was quite bonding and quite, it was personal to everyone.
Yeah, people have often said, you know, in some ways comedy is harder than drama. And then if you go further, you say to play the hero is oftentimes harder than the villain. And not to take away from Tom Berenger, who is fabulous as Barnes. So that whole scene where, you know, this is reality, I am reality. It's wonderful.
Right.
But I think your character is tough because how do you play the good guy? How do you play this character who is looking out for Charlie Sheen and trying to be genuine? How do you play a guy who is the good guy ostensibly in this film, which is set in the jungle where there's so much pain and so much violence?
Oh, you know, it's the truth is that it parallels something in the Florida Project. I had very concrete things to do. And when you have concrete things to accomplish in terms of action, in terms of doing things, it's easier to apply yourself to the scenes, and you don't think about whether you're the hero or the villain. So I wasn't conscious of that. I was playing the scenes. I was trying to be a soldier. I was trying to take care of Charlie. It's good old-fashioned pretending. But I will say, you know, my character in that had a beautiful setup, just dramatically how he ends particularly and how he gets set up. It's a very, it's structured, it's a character that's structured beautifully.
Yeah.
Tom Berenger, that's a performance of a lifetime. I mean, he goes deep. He taps into a scary anger and a scary disappointment that really just jumps off the screen. I haven't seen it in a while, but the last time I saw it, that was the performance that really wowed me.
In the way that your character smiles when he sees Barnes and then realizes, oh no, this isn't going to end well. And that death scene, Willem, it's one of the most memorable death scenes in any film ever. Tell me about shooting it. Did Oliver make it so explicit he wanted to have your arms up, that Christ figure, which became the cover of the movie?
No. You know, he didn't tell me anything about that. It was just a practical thing. I'm reaching for the helicopter. I'm playing my actions. I'm running. It from an actor's point of view, it was a very simple scene. I'm running for my life. And I'm trying to reach the helicopter. A very concrete action to do. And it's just like an athlete that's running a race, you know. There's a very concrete action to do. You think, oh, that's not emotional. Well, watch a guy do, sprint in a pressured situation. It's a very emotional thing to watch, because your whole body, your whole mind is dedicated to this action. There's no reflection. It's pure nature. So that was a great setup, and then of course it was filmed beautifully, and they laid that Samuel Barber Adagio for strings over it, which was a good choice of music for it. That was like a great opportunity, and I was just there to receive it. I'm not being falsely modest. I'm just saying that it was really, you know, you need, as an actor, you have to be able to fill those opportunities. You have to meet them and run with them. no pun intended. But really, it was a great setup.
Well, I think you're right in saying that you really were kind of carrying out Oliver's vision. And, you know, when you have a great director, my favorite director is Martin Scorsese. When you worked with him on Last Temptation of Christ, you know, you clearly were the vessel for a project that was so incredibly personal to Marty. And he was facing, obviously, so much criticism from some people. Tell me about taking on a role like that.
Well, that was a beautiful experience. People forget it was a very low-budget movie. So we were driven by necessity, but thank God... Marty Scorsese, this was a personal film for him, and it was also a film that he had very, very well realized in his mind. So he's a master filmmaker, so that was a huge pleasure. Also, it's a movie that required a lot of me. And I think that's when I work best, when I'm under the gun, when I have, you know, a demanding role. That's when I feel best.
Yeah, in terms of preparation, I'm sure it's a matter of not just the Kazantzakis novel, but maybe seeing other biblical films or actually reading the Bible itself. And Marty himself, of course, is such a cinephile himself. He must have given you maybe the scenes or movies that he wanted you to channel. Like, what was the research like to play a role like Jesus?
Well, the funny thing is you want to sort of forget about Jesus because the whole thing is to play the human part of him. So I wanted to cleanse myself of any expectations or any imagery, really. He did tell me to watch Pasolini's Gospel of Matthew, according to Matthew, or I forget the proper title. I should know it because I played Pasolini. But he told me to watch that film. That's the only instruction he gave me. He gave me some articles about forgiveness. Of course, I read the Bible some, and just so I could get the story straight in my head. And it was really about cleansing myself of, I wanted to start from zero rather than accumulate images or thoughts about it. So it was kind of more because he was a passive character, a character that's acted on and then he reacts. It was really about placing myself in a way that the story could work on me and it could work through me. So the research was really about coming into the scenes as clean as I could, as simple as I could, and then being receptive to them.
How physically grueling! Like the ending is so beautifully rendered when you see what, you know, Christ obviously resisted. You know what the whole point of the film is. How physically grueling the crucifixion scenes, and like you said, the fact that you're under a tight budget and you're trying to just wrench all this emotional performance into the film. How tough was that?
It was very physical, but that's where I live. That's where I feel happiest when I'm doing physical things. So it was a pleasure.
Well, I was reading the Hollywood Reporter. They have a great roundtable. I encourage everyone to check it out. It's an interview not only with Willem, but other actors who are generating a lot of positive words this holiday season. And one of the best parts I liked, Willem, was they asked each of you your favorite performances. And Sam Rockwell said, anything in The Deer Hunter. You know, my dad looked a little bit like De Niro. He has the mole. Mm-hmm. I love that movie. Mm-hmm. James Franco said, the De Niro of Mean Streets and Taxi Driver and Raging Bull. Those three great movies. Your choice was Boris Karloff from Frankenstein. Tell me why that performance is one that you love.
Just because it was so theatrical and muscular, but at the same time it was very touching and very human. So it had this kind of strength, but also a fragility. And it's a beautiful thing to see when you can balance opposites. At the same time, it's like holding two contradictory arguments in your head. That's really when you start to understand things. So Boris Karloff, you know, I'm sure in the day it was considered quite a, I don't know what it was considered in the day, but when I was a kid, it was like a kid's movie. It was a horror movie. But if you really look at it, it's a beautiful performance.
The two things that I think about with Boris Karloff, one, I love Martin Landau playing Bela Lugosi and Ed Wood, and he's just always angry about Karloff, saying, "Well, who, you know, how easy is it to play up? How tough is that monster?" So
that's the first thing I think, and the second thing
is, of course, your performance in Shadow of the Vampire. So I saw the Karloff, I said maybe you just had an appreciation for those types of movies, but that was a wonderful performance too. I hope people recognize how good you were in Shadow of the Vampire, and I hope that was a fruitful experience for you.
Oh, it was a beautiful experience. It was really fun because I had such a strong mask. So sometimes it's beautiful because when you sit in a makeup chair for 3-4 hours and you lose yourself and you're totally free, you become another character. You look in the mirror, you look different, you feel different. It really opens the door to a pure pretending. And I had a good model because basically I'm starting from a place of imitation. I'm really using the Nosferatu film as a base to start from. You can never truly copy, but sometimes that's a good place to start. It's like what musicians do all the time, you know? You learn the scales, and then you depart from them, you know? You learn the song, and then you depart from them.
Right. Two more movies, and I promise we'll get you out of here. I love two films you did with Paul Schrader, Autofocus and Affliction. Autofocus, to me, is such an underrated movie. Owen Gleiberman, the film critic for Variety, said that was the first great film about sex addiction. And your performance, I mean, the relationship you have as Carp or Carpy with Greg Kinnear, I just think that's a movie that it was just, people don't appreciate how powerful it was, just the throes of addiction that character's in, and your character, and especially the dilemma that each guy faces when they try to break apart. What was Autofocus like? Because I think it was amazing.
Good. I'm glad you like that movie. It's a good movie. I've worked with Paul Schrader 5-6 times.
Right.
I think it's underseen, but I don't think it's underappreciated. You know, some movies just don't get their get a strong release. And I think that was one of them. But I think it's a strong movie, and it's something I really enjoyed doing.
And another movie that I love, speaking of Paul Schrader, is Affliction. Everything about that movie, just the way it's shot and Nick Nolte's performance and your relationship. I think Paul said, he goes, you know, when you watch the movie, maybe you even said this in an interview, when you watch the movie, you think it's Wade Whitehouse's story, meaning Nick Nolte's character. But when you watch it again, it's actually your story. It's Rolf's story. It's the brother of Wade. And especially, I love that haunting narration at the end, the last time where you say, except that I continue. I mean, that Lisa Schwartzbaum had a great review of it. She called it a magnificent feel-bad movie. But I love Affliction.
It's, you know, it comes from a beautiful novel by Russell Banks. Paul is very good at dealing with very hot emotional and spiritual issues in a very detached, aestheticized way. And this film was no exception. The role really is both Coburn, Sissy Spacek, and also Nick Nolte is fantastic in it. They're great performances. I'm kind of in there for support, but I was happy to be there.
Well, I love the scene. You know, even there's humor, even amid serious subject matter. The scene where you say to Nick Nolte's character, Wade Whitehouse, I was never afflicted by that man's capacity for violence, speaking of Coburn.
Yeah.
And Nolte gives a big laugh and goes, that's what you think.
Yeah, it's good. No, it's beautiful. It's beautiful writing. The novel is great. If people respond to that movie, they should check out other novels by Russell Banks, including one called Continental Drift that really was very prescient about the issue of immigration.
The last thing I read from the Hollywood Reporter, William, you said if you weren't an actor, you'd be a cook or a farmer. Where does that desire come from?
You know, I guess, you know, when you get asked those kinds of questions, you're not giving a lot of deep thought. But I always admire, I like losing myself in practical things. I like washing dishes. I like to cook. I like to work in, when I had a vegetable garden, it was very satisfying. So I don't really think about doing those things, and I'm sure I have a very romantic view of them. But a life where you're connected to nature and you're connected to making things in a practical way, this is very appealing to me. And in fact, as an actor, that's what I try to do.
Willem Dafoe, the film is The Florida Project. He's outstanding in it, as is the movie. Thanks so much for the time, Willem. I really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you. Good talking to you.
All right. So that was Willem Dafoe. Obviously a terrific actor. So great to have him here. And like I said, he is going to be probably winning the Oscar for supporting actor for The Florida Project. Either he or Sam Rockwell. Once again, if you go to Gold Derby, you'll see the latest picks. A couple more movies here for you before we get to our second guest, Richard Jenkins, who is excellent in The Shape of Water. The first one is one that a lot of people have been tweeting me about. Mark Simon recommended it to me. My buddy Adam Amin mentioned it to me. So, of course, I had to watch Jim and Andy. And on paper, this is a movie that I would really enjoy because it's about Jim Carrey, who's one of my favorite comedians, fellow Canadian. And it's about the behind the scenes of a movie, which is kind of great material for someone like me. And it's about when he played Andy Kaufman in Man on the Moon and all the behind-the-scenes footage, which has never been released before. So I'm thinking this is going to be a home run for me. And early on, I like it. I like the style of it. It's a documentary which is focusing on Jim going back and telling the story of when he became Andy Kaufman. And again, either you're going to go with this or you're not going to. Either you're a true thespian and you believe in art and you believe in transcending oneself and becoming another person, because Jim Carrey makes it clear. I was not Jim. Jim was gone. I was Andy Kaufman. I channeled him. I was him from the outside in, from the inside out. So I don't necessarily remember certain things. Like I was playing Andy all the way. And when Andy has to play like other characters, like his boorish alter ego, then again, Jim would assume that responsibility. So what works is especially the opening, because you see him actually on set. And there's scenes where Milos Forman, the director, of course, Amadeus, among other films, is trying to ask him to do another take. He's like, Jim, another take. He's like, oh, I'm not Jim. Like, no, okay, Andy, can we just do another take? And he's like, no, nothing. So it's like, oh, thank you very much. Like, he's doing the whole taxi bit. And you're like, okay, he's being difficult because Andy was difficult on the set of Taxi. And in life, Andy was difficult. And whenever Andy just felt like pushing buttons, he would do this. So on the one hand, I can imagine Milos Forman's frustration saying, all right, I'm trying to make a movie about this guy. And I get that you're acting in the frame of it, but how do I get through to Jim to say, do that again, just try it a little bit differently? Instead, I'm talking to Andy, and I'm asking Andy to reenact a part of his life differently. Like, how the hell do I do this? So I really felt a lot for the challenge of him, Milos Forman, the director, not to mention the other actors. Not nearly enough Giamatti. There's only like one shot of Giamatti. He turns the camera and he's like, this is crazy, this is freaky, because Jim's not Jim, because Jim is now Andy Kaufman. And, you know, Giamatti plays his right-hand man in the movie, if you haven't seen Man on the Moon. So you've got, like, Andy Dick in there. Danny DeVito, of course, DeVito knew Andy Kaufman very well. So you see scenes of Carrey, and he's busting on DeVito, and then DeVito's telling the cameraman, going like, yeah, no, that's exactly what Andy was like. He would just be difficult on the set of Taxi. But after a while, the movie really becomes repetitive, and I started to just get frustrated. I said, okay, what is the point of this? What really is the point of this documentary from director Chris Smith? Because, I get the fact that he's difficult, and I get the fact it's interesting that you have this footage. But after a while, it becomes repetitive. So Jim Carrey, years ago, acted like a jerk when he was playing Andy Kaufman in Man on the Moon, because that's what the actor did. Okay, what else is there to the movie? It's 94 minutes, and it's got that tongue-in-cheek humor evidenced by the title, Jim and Andy, The Great Beyond, featuring a very special contractually obligated mention of Tony Clifton. By the way, when he plays Tony Clifton, it's unbelievable, because Tony Clifton was a very difficult guy. He's like, okay, all right, now I'm going to be Tony Clifton. All right, okay. So, I mean, one of the best scenes of the movie is Milos Forman talking to Tony Clifton, going, Tony, you can't do this. Tony Clifton's like throwing us around. Okay, I'll do whatever I want. Okay, all right, that's fine then. Okay, all right, Tony's coming back. He's going, Tony, can you just please do this? No, okay, all right, I don't feel like that. Like, honestly, now with all the focus and the rightful scrutiny on sexual harassment, like, I was thinking about this guy, Tony Clifton, the way his alter ego was, I'm sure he's grabbing women inappropriately, definitely making inappropriate jokes, obviously acting in a very abusive manner. So I wonder, like, again, if you're Forman, if you're the other actors, at what point do you say, okay, I get the fact Jim Carrey's a method actor, but at one point, is this just a license to be a jerk? At what point is Jim Carrey just acting like a jerk? And you can say, all right, I get that you're channeling Andy Kaufman, but this is now a pain because we're trying to get the shot right. We've had it lit this way. We've got 20 minutes to get this, and you're just acting like a jerk. So be a professional and just do the job, and you can do it without having to somehow get in the presence of Andy Kaufman. So like I said, the drawback to me, the reason I'm only giving it 2 Maple Leafs is it just gets too repetitive. Like, I got it. Jim Carrey's acting like a jerk. Let's move on. But that's not to say the footage isn't interesting. And the scenes that I like the most is when it kind of focuses on Jim. Because maybe you're 18, 19, listening to this podcast. You weren't alive for those movies in the 90s. But Jim Carrey was as big as it got. Like, he was a megastar. Like, his comedies were must-see television. And now, if you wonder what's happened to Jim Carrey, like, now people often wonder, like, his girlfriend passed away. Like, I guess they'd broken up prior to her suicide, but he was being sued. If you saw him in Comedians in Cars getting coffee with Seinfeld, like, he was cool, but he seems like very mellow now and very serious and very quiet. And, you know, he just focused on his painting, doesn't appear to be interested in acting. He did I Love You, Philip Morris, which I didn't see, but it's a small film. So it's like now he's kind of he's a very artistic guy. But if you wonder what happened to madcap, zany, fun Jim Carrey, now he's very serious, very introverted Jim Carrey.
If you had to guess, how old do you think Jim Carrey is?
53?
Older. 55.
Yeah, see, I remember when I heard he was a grandfather. I'm like, oh, my God. I think it was at 50. But he's 55, and you go, man, he looks great. The funniest line, my buddy Mike Glennon, who was a part of the strong contingent.
The Bears quarterback?
The part of the strong contingent at Lemoyne College. He said to me, because at one point I just realized, like, Jim Carrey's just lost it. Like, Jim Carrey has now left our universe. Spoiler alert, the final line of it, like he recaps the whole story of Playing in the Coffin, and he looks at the camera. This actually makes the documentary worth seeing, just for this line alone. Jim Carrey looks at the camera and goes, what if I just came back as Jesus? And I'm like, okay, at that point, yeah, Jim Carrey is officially off his rocker. Jim and Andy and the Great Beyond is currently on Netflix. You can check out that documentary there. One more film to talk about before we get to the new film. Excuse me, an interview with Richard Jenkins from The Shape of Water. And that's a new film from Aaron Sorkin, Molly's Game, which stars Jessica Chastain. It's the true story, or based on the true story, I should say, of Molly Bloom, who ran these high-stakes poker rings. Did so for years, and it involved actors. You don't mention them in the movie, but Ben Affleck was a part of it. Leonardo DiCaprio was a part of it. They've got Michael Cera in the movie. So Cera, I don't know if he's just playing himself, or he's just supposed to play by proxy one of these Hollywood actors. But initially, she was working with these actors and such, and then later it became Italian gangsters, and then it became Russian mafia, ended up going into a different world. And she goes from a girl who's just this assistant, making $300 a night in tips in these poker games, to eventually running these illegal gambling rings on her own. And the backstory to it is interesting. She was actually an Olympic skier. First 5 minutes is great, because the first question is this. Aaron Sorkin's an unbelievable writer, one of the best writers alive. Every time he puts in a great script, it's fun dialogue, it's great to listen to, won an Oscar for The Social Network, and I have loved Steve Jobs. I thought it was a great film. Obviously, West Wing, all the rest of it, American President. So I'm like, how is he going to do as a director? And it's like, well, you know, the first 5 minutes immediately quell any anxiety because he just shows this character of Molly when she's skiing. And so immediately he's got some, you know, very visceral, quick cuts of her skiing and the moguls, and Kevin Costner plays her father, who is this difficult, you know, demanding coach, as many would expect in that vein. And for the first 5.5 minutes, it's a great prologue. All right, now I'm into the movie. Like, Sorkin does an excellent job from there. But I just found it curious that this was the movie he chose to make as his directorial debut. He's 56 years old. He could have his pick of the litter when it comes to projects. His next project, he's working on A Few Good Men, like a live TV adaptation for NBC with Alec Baldwin playing Colonel Nathan Jessup. You know, he loves the play more than anything. He wishes he could.
Who's
just
playing Cruz?
I don't know. They've only announced Baldwin so far. They pushed it back for a year. But, like, you know, Aaron Sorkin can do anything. I just thought, like, people have asked him, what about a West Wing reboot with Trump in power? And he's like, well, I have thought about it because, you know, it's obviously ripe material. But I guess there's challenges as to what he would do with all the characters he has said. But I just find it interesting. If somebody said to me, Aaron Sorkin's going to direct a movie at the age of 56. I'm like, oh, okay, probably politically oriented or The Newsroom or Dialogue. No, it's with this female poker player who got busted for a gambling ring. I'm like, oh, okay, particular decision. And it's a good movie, but it's certainly not a great movie. And it's interesting they're putting it now with all this awards bait where I think it kind of is going to get lost in the shuffle. Originally, they had told Sorkin they were going to put it out in February, and he said, no way. Like, he knows his movies and his audiences for critically acclaimed, like-minded people. So he's got to get an Oscar nomination for script. He's got to get Chastain a nomination, and then people will check it out. As he said, who the hell wants to have their movie open up in February? But now I think it's got a Christmas Day release, and like I said, I got the screener, and thanks to the fine folks who sent it to me. But I think it's a good film, but I don't think it's spectacular. Chastain's excellent. She's always been a terrific actress, and once again, it's a very good role for her. I mean, basically, she just puts on a lot of makeup and puts on her tight cocktail dresses and starts seducing all these rich men. So it's a different term for her. Idris Elba plays the lawyer who tries to support her. I think he it's kind of a smaller role for him. I actually thought it was a little underwritten. One of the criticisms of Sorkin is that his female characters need to have men who kind of free them or liberate them or find their standing. I actually thought in this film, the character of Molly is really well written and well played by Chastain. I thought Elba's character came across a little bit half-baked. And even the structure of it, he's telling Molly's story when she's running the gambling ring, but then also flipping to present day in his structure when you know she's going to court and has to fight the case. So I did like the ending. It was a surprise ending, and Sorkin's always a smart guy. But I thought it was solid but not A-list Aaron Sorkin-type material. His dialogue is always fun to listen to, so I think he may get a nomination for screenplay. Chastain right now in Gold Derby, just on the outside looking in for a nomination. She's running 6 out of 5. But if you like Aaron Sorkin, if you like poker, I should say that. Hell, if you love poker, you'll love this movie. I'm not a gambler. I'm not a poker player. So they have this one sequence that's very innovative in which they start explaining you know, the nut flush and all the different expressions and such. I'm sure if you love the movie Rounders, then you'll love a movie like Molly's Game. So I'm giving it 3 Maple Leafs because of Sorkin's script and because of the performances. That film coming to see theaters soon. And now it's time to hear from Richard Jenkins. Richard Jenkins has long been a talented character actor, and then he got a starring role, which really put him on the map and gave him an Academy Award nomination for Best Actor for The Visitor. Now he's getting a lot of pub for a supporting actor Oscar nomination, perhaps for his work in The Shape of Water, a terrific new film from Guillermo del Toro. Richard, what was your reaction when you first heard about this project?
I just had no idea what it was going to be. And I sat down, I started to read the script, and I loved this part so much that every time I would turn the page, I would say, please don't die, please don't die. And that's how you know you love something. So I sent an email the next day and said, I think I do love this as much as you do. And that's how the whole thing began.
Guillermo del Toro has said that he cast his movies with the way he looks at a person's eyes. If you look at Octavia Spencer's eyes or Sally Hawkins' eyes or Michael Sheen, that helps him see the character. And in your case, you know, your character is very compassionate. You're the one who the audience can identify with this dilemma you have trying to help this woman in this really dangerous adventure. How did you approach this role perhaps differently than other ones?
Well, it's kind of the same. You see what's on the page, what's written, and who this person is that's in this story. And the fact is, he's not very compassionate in the beginning. He has his own life, which I love. He has his own problems, his own dreams, desires. And when she asks him, Sally Hawkins asks me to help her, I say no. I you know, why do you do this on today of all days when I'm going to get my job back and things are happening for me? You want me to do this. And until you know, until his whole world falls apart and then he realizes who his one true friend is, it's her, does he come around and say, I'll do whatever you want me to do. So I love the fact that this guy actually had an arc, a character arc, that he starts out one thing and ends up another thing. So it was great fun to do.
You know, every character in this story, Richard, is an outsider. You're this gay man. You know, you've got that great line about you're the proverbial starving artist. Octavia Spencer is a black woman in the early 1960s. And then Sally is this mute woman. So all of you are outsiders. All of you are not, you know, received well within the conventions of society. And I love that one scene where Sally's watching television. She puts on like a civil rights demonstration. And right away, your character comes over and says, no, change the channel. I don't want to see that. Like your character just wants to focus on old Hollywood musicals and eat pie with her and not force that reality. Is that what you took from that scene specifically?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. That he's trying to create the world he's going to live in. And he's trying to push away any unpleasantness, even though his world is filled with it. And I think that's part of the change you see in him when he's willing to finally man up and do the right thing and help her. It's a big leap for this guy.
I said earlier, Richard, in my review of the film that Guillermo del Toro is really audacious in the way he puts this picture together. You know, it's Beauty and the Beast, it's modern retelling. And I love that scene because it really is a movie for movie lovers, that scene where the creature and Sally, you know, they are in their own musical. And it's one of those scenes where either it's going to work for the audience and it doesn't. But for me, I thought it was beautiful and it really kind of captured the spirit of the film. How did you take that?
Well, it's true, because I think he worried about it. You know, he worried about it. He said, will they buy this? Will they go with this? And, you know, that's, I said to him, well, that's because you're making a piece of art here, you know, and it's a risk. So, you know, I love the fact you're taking a lot of risks with this. And but it's incredible, you know, what audiences accept and understand in this film. I know he's really thrilled by that, and it's pretty great. But it was a risk, you know. How do you make this work? And if you try to explain this movie to someone, you go, oh, a woman falls in love with a fish man.
And that's the thing that I love about this movie is it takes a lot of chances. Like, how tough was this to pitch? Like, what, Creature from the Black Lagoon? Who's going to see this when you're pitching it to executives?
I don't think anybody. I've not heard a great pitch for this movie. I've not heard a description of this movie. I go, that's it. I just haven't heard it. It's so difficult to categorize. And I think that's what makes it really interesting.
Richard Jenkins, currently starring in the new film from Guillermo del Toro, The Shape of Water. As I mentioned off the top, Richard, I just love that film, The Visitor, and your starring performance in it. You were nominated for Best Actor and a very worthy nomination. You know, you talk about gutsy movies. That story, you're this professor who's awfully repressed, and then you have a family living in your apartment, and the story then becomes about immigration and falling in love late in life, and you're playing the drums. And I mean, I was so happy when Tom McCarthy won an Oscar for Spotlight, because I thought McCarthy's been making excellent movies for years, not only Win-Win with Paul Giamatti, but The Visitor with yourself. Tell me about that experience and just how transformative it was.
Well, it was, you know, it's one of those things where you just can't believe it's happening. It was an extraordinary time, and Tom McCarthy, you know, trusted me enough to offer me this part. And I'll be forever beholden to him, because it was a beautiful experience. And he called me up one day and he said, I wrote this part for you, and tell me if you want to do it or not. And so I read the script and I called him back and I said, I don't think anybody's going to give you the money to do this movie with me in this part. And he said, that wasn't my question. My question is, do you want to do it? You let me worry about the money. And that's how it began. You know, I mean, it was extraordinary. It, you know, it just came out of the blue.
It must be nice to have somebody who believes in you. I thought your performance was tremendous from start to finish. But the scene in particular I really loved is at the end when you're confronting you know, the immigration services, and you're just so frustrated, and you're doing that thing with your fingers, like, can you even hear me? Tell me about that scene. What was that like for you?
Well, it was interesting, because it was kind of at the end of the shoot we did that scene, so it was frustrating. You know, I mean, you did feel that. You felt that kind of institutionalized frustration come up. You know, it's like nobody will tell you anything. That's because they don't know. Nobody tells them anything. It's really frustrating when someone you really care about is at the other end of it. So it wasn't hard, but it's so ineffectual, my kind of ranting there. It's just not going to get anybody anywhere. So it was interesting to do. You feel like nobody is hearing you. It was an amazing project to do. We rehearsed it for 3 weeks, and Tom's a smart dude, and we kind of used that rehearsal period for the cast to become friends. So we had breakfast, lunch, dinner together for 3 weeks, and hung out, laughed, and, you know, it was really a great time. So by the time we began the movie, we all knew each other, and we didn't have to. There's a lot of times in a movie, you don't know anybody on the movie, and you kind of wish you could go back and reshoot some of the stuff at the end of the movie. You know, but he took care of that problem with the rehearsal period, so I was really grateful for that.
I don't know if you're musically inclined, but how proficient were you by the end of playing the drums?
I sucked. But, you know, I was a drummer when I was a young guy. I played drums for 5 years, and I was never any good. You know, if you're a drummer and you're worried about losing the beat, you should be doing something else. And that was my deal with it. But it was enough. I could do it enough so I had a little speed in my hands. I could kind of go fast, but I couldn't play anything. You know, and interesting, because my son was a drummer, and he was a fantastic drummer, but I just never had it in me.
We had Billy Bob Thornton on the podcast, and of course we love him. He's such a talented actor and a great guy. And I told him my favorite film of his is actually The Man Who Wasn't There. And to my surprise, he said that's actually his favorite as an actor as well. And you have a small, but I think a very memorable role playing Scarlett Johansson's father in the movie. And I love that scene on the porch where your character is just completely blitzed and you're trying to give him advice about the legal process. And you're saying, yeah, Riedenschneider, the best. What was that movie like?
It was the first Coen Brothers movie I did, and I'd done three with them, and I just love these guys. They're just the best. But it wasn't written that he was drunk that night. But every scene that I did in the script, it said that he had a glass of booze with him, whether it was in the library. I mean, I think I had three scenes. But every scene, he had a drink in his hand. So I thought, well, this is late at night. If he's been doing this all day, not be in too good a shape. So that's what we did. And it was fun. Yeah, it worked.
The Coen brothers are so unique. I could just imagine as an actor, it's like just diving into red meat. Like you're just so thrilled to be a part of this process because they're giving you such great material to work with, right?
Well, they are. They're, you know, and they're fast. They're fast because they have confidence in what they do. And they write so well. And it's just a great atmosphere on a Coen set. They're great guys, and they love making films, and they're great at it. So for me, it was because I had auditioned for them. My first one was Raising Arizona, and I auditioned for Fargo, and I came back for the Bill Macy part. I think I auditioned two or three times, and I didn't get it, and I was like upset. And then I went to the movie and I saw Bill Macy do it. And I thought, oh, okay, I get it now. I wouldn't cast me either, you know, because he was so fantastic in it. So I never thought I'd end up being in one of their films. And all of a sudden they called me up and said, we want you to do this. So it was great.
An actor like yourself, Richard, you've worked for so many years and you've worked in so many different genres. I don't want to dismiss your work in comedies. You know, you were in Step Brothers, you're in Me, Myself, and Irene, you're in There's Something About Mary. What was it like working with the Farrelly brothers in the latter two films?
Well, like the Coens, there's two of them. It's fun. It's, you know, Peter and Bobby are just, you know, really smart guys and a lot of fun. And if your job in life is to be in movies or make movies and you're not having fun, you're doing something wrong. This should not be a chore to do this job. And these guys understand that. And they know that it's a privilege to do this. So, you know, it's a ball working with them.
It's always a privilege to see you on the screen. I've often said whenever Richard Jenkins is in a film, he enhances the overall project. And that is certainly true of your latest film, Guillermo del Toro's The Shape of Water. I hope you get another Oscar nomination, this time for supporting. And I thank you so much for the time, Richard. I really appreciate it.
Oh, I really appreciate that. Thanks for the kind words, man.
Streaming suggestions.
Since we reviewed previously in the pod, Jim and Andy from Jim Carrey, how about Ace Ventura, a pet detective on Netflix? I remember the scorching Siskel and Ebert gave this movie, and they said it was epitomized by the scene in which Carrey talks out of his butt. Which, I mean, if you're like 14 years old, that's a reason to go see a movie. You're like, wait, there's a grown man who talks out of his butt? And then asks for a mint to tone loke. I'm like, I'm in. Of course, that was a huge hit. If you've never seen it, you have no idea what you're getting into. All righty then. There's a lot to like about Ace Ventura, Pet Detective, even though it got quite a pounding from Siskel and Ebert. That is currently on Netflix if you want to revisit Jim Carrey in the role that really kind of made him a huge star after In Living Color. On Hulu, so last time we had our buddy Bonds do a guest review, I'd like somebody to do a guest review of the following film, which I have not seen. I have no interest in seeing it, but I want someone to review it for me. It's Basic Instinct 2, Risk Addiction. So if you can send in a tweet, we now have 280 characters, so go ahead. Send in your tweet to CinephileESPN, and then Dan and I will monitor the best one. If anybody actually wants to watch what was probably just an awful movie, but write us a very entertaining Twitter review, I'll read it next time. It's currently on Hulu. Buffalo 66 from Vincent Gallo. What happened to Vincent Gallo? He makes this movie called Buffalo 66. It's about this romance, and he's this drifter, and Christina Ricci. It's got this great scene with Ben Gazzara, which he's singing this song to her. And Gallo made this movie, which was, you know, really played well in the indie circuit, and people really appreciated the film. And by the way, Buffalo 66, there's a sports tie-in to it. He's a huge Buffalo Bills fan, and it goes back to what the kicker did in 1966. So there's definitely shades of Scott Norwood in the storytelling of it. But Gallo does this move. He's really well-received. Then he makes a movie called The Brown Bunny. Roger Ebert said The Brown Bunny was the worst film in the history of the Cannes Film Festival. And Vincent Gallo was so understandably upset, he just unleashed this like verbal tirade against Roger Ebert. And Ebert's response, one of the all-time classics from any critic, he said, because the big thing Gallo criticized is weight, kept calling him fat and all these different, you know, synonyms for fat. And Ebert said, my weight may fluctuate, but Vincent Gallo will always be the director of The Brown Bunny. Case closed. Lousiest movie ever. Apparently it's famous for like this scene of fellatio. Like the, I've never seen The Brown Bunny, but people tell me it's just god-awful. Chloe 70 is a co-star in that. The other film currently on Hulu I want people to check out, it's called In the Line of Fire. John Malkovich, one of his best roles, Academy Award nominated, playing the villain who wants to kill the president. Clint Eastwood stars on this film, directed by Wolfgang Peterson. I love the chemistry between the entire cast, not only Eastwood and Malkovich, but also Eastwood and Rene Russo. This one scene I never forget, he says, you know, when a girl's walking away from you, if she looks back, that means she's interested. And it's a really good script. Jeff McGuire, I believe, wrote the script. I think he was nominated, actually, for screenplay that year, for original screenplay. But I like those moments with Russo and, of course, Malkovich and Eastwood. They've got Eastwood's got all these different frustrations. And I just remember when the, like a cauldron, when it finally bubbles over and he finally gets angry at Malkovich. They've got this great scene on the phone. They're just screaming at each other. But if you like a good political thriller, I recommend In the Line of Fire. That's currently on Hulu. Last HBO Now, just to continue the Clint Eastwood theme, check out Gran Torino. I only saw it once. I liked it. I feel like it's topical now because it's this character who's this like repugnant racist who ends up, I wouldn't say necessarily finding his calling, but I think he has an about face in some of his views while still being this crotchety old guy. It's also memorable for the fact Clint Eastwood sings. I just remember watching the film, and I did like the movie, but like the final 5 minutes, he starts singing, and you go, geez, I'm not sure about that musical choice. Midnight Cowboy, Dustin Hoffman in the news because John Oliver went after him about the groping allegations based when Hoffman did Death of a Salesman. If you want to just focus on Dustin Hoffman's movies rather than his behavior, check out Midnight Cowboy. And I'm walking here. And Species, I only mentioned that, starring Canadian starlet Natasha Henstridge, because if you like The Shape of Water and you like a good monster movie, you'll like Species. Good B-movie, entertaining. And she's obviously very attractive. Check out Species on HBO Now. Rick Passmore, I knew it. I knew Passmore would have something on Species. Go ahead.
No, I don't have anything on Species. I'm surprised you're not plugging Silence on Hulu and Amazon.
Yeah, I feel like I've badgered our audience into just so much Silence conversation. At this point, I'm even disgusted when I bring up Silence. So you did send that to me. I said I will spare the audience. But now we have another Silence mention. Thanks to you, Ricky.
Hey, if you're not going to do it, I was.
I appreciate it. Thanks so much for listening to Cinephile. Obviously, this is a great time for movies. We'll be back at it shortly. So thanks once again to checking out Cinephile. Tell all your friends about it. Subscribe. Do all the rest of it. And, of course, leave a message on Apple iTunes. Although people have been often asking me now where to find the podcast. So, of course, TuneIn is the podcast to check it out exclusively there. Then you'll get on iTunes and the ESPN app. But leave us a review on iTunes. I rank the movies at a 4 Maple Leafs. You can do it out of 5 stars. And leave a comment for us as well. Until next time, I'll see you at the movies.
Don't miss out on the next episode of Cinephile. Subscribe to the Adnan Furk Movie Podcast by clicking the Listen tab in the ESPN app.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.